Voices of VR podcast. Hello, my name is Ken Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So continuing on my series from Venice Immersive 2025, today's episode is about an experience called A Long Goodbye, which was a part of the competition and actually ended up winning like the third place prize there at Venice this past year. So it's a virtual reality piece that you're going in, and it's essentially a story about a husband who has a wife and she's basically losing her memory. And so you're kind of going through and recounting all sorts of different dimensions of her memory. And it's in some ways told from the perspective of you are embodying this woman who's losing her memory. And so there's a bit of you are pushing this tape recorder and you're kind of learning about your life as if you forgot everything about yourself. And so the different contexts that are being explored, so it's a lot about self and identity and the loss of memory and all the ways that we capture and record our identity. From the description, it says, like pieces of a puzzle, memories and conversations help Ida rediscover herself. So there's artifacts of shared experiences and memories shared within the spatial context of a home, as well as the husband and the caretaker as the other protagonist's main character, with Ida, who's this 72-year-old pianist living with dementia. And music is a big part of her life, both of her creative expression as well as her career, and all of the various kind of adventures that they have together. So it's kind of a meditation on all those different memories and also the relationship between the husband and wife and also him as he becomes a caregiver. So the elemental center of gravity, very much the water element and the story driven, both Kate and Victor are coming from the realm of film. And so, and Kate also having this deep background in literature and writing, and Victor is coming in as a center photographer. And so that's very much flavoring all the different ways in which they're treating the immersive context of this piece. So it's very narrative driven, and it's this kind of very painterly animation with a lot of like watercolors, a very unique look and feel to it as well. And lots of different immersive and interactive components as well. I think they managed to make this interactive components where it wasn't just like, you know, interactivity to gate the experience, although you were moving around in a way that felt like you're spatially editing it with the different change blindness aspects that were happening as you're moving your body. So it created more of a cinematic feel than I'm used to seeing with some of these different experiences because of the way that they're using this kind of spatial change blindness editing. So it's an incredible score with lots of different themes for different characters. So the music was absolutely incredible. And I think it also, you know, helped to bring about this real deep and emotionally moving piece overall. And so the world starts to change and dissolve as the main protagonist's memory also fades, giving you a sense of time and unfolding processes and that nothing's permanent within this world. Even the world is starting to fall apart and dissolve. And because Victor was a cinematographer, I think he's leaning into discovering all these very canny ways of moving your body through space to give you a sense of the kind of movement of a camera, but you're also kind of editing it of sorts because of the change blindness effects. Change blindness is basically when you look in one direction, you look back and something's changed. And so it gives you this sense of spatial editing that has this kind of rhythm and flow that I feel like is very similar to kind of film editing, although there's a much more responsive to your movements in a way that it feels kind of magical in that sense. But overall, the piece is very emotionally driven. It's one of the pieces that brought the most emotion out of me watching the pieces this year at Venice Immersive. So that was the water element as the primary center of gravity. The second center of gravity, I'd say, is the earth element in terms of the embodiment and the environmental presence. And so the world that they've created is very transportive. It's a very distinct watercolor aesthetic. And they worked with their designer. They did a lot of generative AI concept art, and they provided a very specific detail for what they wanted. And then they pulled off this really rich watercolor type of look and feel. If you take a look at the artist statement, you'll get a sense of some of the different aesthetics that are involved. But it's very transportive. You feel like you're kind of walking into another world. So there's lots of embodied movements throughout this piece, and you're constantly moving around. And as you're moving around this small space, they really make the most out of the space that they're allotted. And it gives you a sense of moving through a much larger space story-wise because you're able to kind of teleport in order to kind of move through this larger sense of space. But there are this kind of mashing up of context in a way that reminded me of this kind of Meow Wolf where you kind of open up the refrigerator and you see a memory that's on the other side. And so you have this blending and blurring of these contexts mash up to each other where you'll be in one context like at your home and you'll see another context of, you know, going on a adventure out in the neighborhood into nature. And also within the context of the piece, there's quite a lot of void space to help to direct your attention, but it also helps to make use of the available space that they have available. So, you know, you are doing this kind of virtual locomotion, which is helping to kind of move you through this space. And then there's a physical installation with post-it notes that help to create a strong magic circle as you're entering into this piece. And so in the actual piece, you see lots of different post-it notes with reminders for Iris, who's like losing her memory, just to give her little notes. And then before you go in there, the whole like wall is just covered with these different post-it notes. And as people went through the experience, and they would give their little spot reviews within the context of these post-it notes. So you're also kind of embodied as a character, as Ida. And this is less clear in the sense, like, you know, if they kind of thought about it, because you are the one who's like pushing the tape player button at certain points, because the conceit is that your husband's kind of recording different messages to you and you're playing them back for yourself. And from the artist statement, Kate and Victor said that when we put on that VR headset, the first questions that come to mind are, who am I? Where am I? And this is the confusion that our protagonist is dealing with. And this became the starting point of the story. So you're embodied as a character in this piece, and you really don't know who you are. And you're kind of learning about who you are, very similar to how Ida would be learning about who she was each and every day because of her dementia. Okay, so the third center of gravity is the fire. These are the different interactive dimensions of the narrative where you are kind of pushing these tape play buttons, but also your embodied movements are having this kind of spatial editing impact. And it creates this real sense of like you are dynamically interacted with the piece, even though it may be fairly linear and no real choices that are being made, but it still feels like your activity, your agency feels a little bit more than just stage gating it. I mean, you are pushing these buttons and it's progressing, but it makes you feel a little bit more engaged than you normally would. But they aspire to get this sense of wandering throughout this piece. And I really feel like they were able to achieve that. And that's not an easy thing to be able to do, especially when you have pretty tight guardrails on the experience overall. And the final center of gravity in terms of the air element, there is quite a lot of dialogue and conversation that's happening, little post-it notes. And you're able to kind of piece together the story as you see the juxtaposition of all these memories that are mashed up to each other. And with the combination of the music and the water and the ways that it's kind of really driving overall this really deep sense of emotion, this emotional journey that you're going on. But there's a bit of the puzzle-like nature of kind of piecing together your identity, yourself, each and every time that you're going through the experience. So some of the different themes are around memory, loss, and grief, and also the slow dissolving of the structure of memory as reflected within the sparse void-like architecture of the piece itself, reflecting this kind of slipping away into liminality. And it's also a lot about this partnership and the love that they share between each other within their partnership. And that says, quote, "It's a poetic experience about the impact of dementia, but above it all, it's about the love and the long goodbye of two lovers who shared a life together." So talking about the details of the condition of dementia, but the husband becomes a caretaker. So that's also a switching of his role and contexts. And the directors say, "A long goodbye is at once a personal and universal story about human connection. It serves as a reminder that people are always so much more than their illness. Instead of focusing on what is lost, we need to stay close and hold on to shared affection." So yeah, that's kind of like the heart of the piece as well. Above all, how can we still remain connected to the people that we love who may be losing their memory? So this is a very emotionally impactful piece. And also there's a lot of people who have actually personally gone through different dimensions of this, you know, just I think has a really strong resonant impact to them. So we're covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Kate and Victor happened on Saturday, August 30th, 2025, at the Venice Immersive Festival in Venice, Italy. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
Hello, I'm Kate Voet. I'm a Belgian-Flemish filmmaker and a screenwriter. I have a background in classic cinema, actually, and this is my debut virtual reality project. So I haven't done anything else yet, but this is the start of my VR adventure.
And my name is Victor Maas. I'm also a Belgian filmmaker. This is my directorial debut, so I've worked more as a cinematographer and a camera assistant on linear film. And then a few years ago, together, we decided to make an immersive piece when there was suddenly a call that came in front of us for cinema creators, like linear film creators, to dive into XR. And we heeded a call, and we had an idea during COVID, during the lockdowns, and we started writing a script, and then we went from there.
Great. Maybe you could each give a bit more context as to your backgrounds and the different design disciplines you're bringing in, but also a bit of your journey into this immersive space.
Yeah, let me think. Because it's so like our journey is sometimes difficult to speak separately because we are also a couple in real life. So we are fully immersed as one person almost in this VR adventure. But I'm going to try to speak individually. So as Victor said, there was a call from the Flemish Film Fund. And this was an amazing opportunity. It was during the pandemic. It was entirely virtual online. And we got coached by two amazing coaches, Yvonne van Ilde and David Calvet. And they really helped us discover anything VR. So they showed us VR pieces that we needed to see. We had weekly sessions where we learned everything about virtual reality, in which we developed the concept we had for this piece along by into a full screenplay. And that's how it came about, how the adventure started. And I think it was so exciting. It was like almost like a training program where we really became virtual reality creators over the course of 6 months, because we were entirely new to the medium. And that was very helpful.
And just any other additional context is your personal background and...
Okay. Yeah, so I have a background in classic cinema. I'm working on various projects, feature films that I'm writing. And but still, this is also my debut project. So I graduated from film school and we applied to funding to write this piece and another piece. So this is my first professional film, even though it's a virtual reality film that comes into the world. So I have a background also in literature, actually. I studied literature, I studied business management, and I studied film directing. So I think maybe people can maybe feel that when they see something I've made. I've done short films that went to festivals and that people can see online. But this is the first one that was funded professionally by the film funds in Europe. So it's very exciting.
And for me, I just studied film directing, filmmaking basically at film school in Brussels. And I've been working in the cinema world for, I think, about 8 years now. So I've worked on a lot of feature films and documentaries and short films, more as a camera assistant and cinematographer. So usually my background is more of a mix of both creative and technical element that I bring to the table. Even though, as you know, at the film school, it's multidisciplinary. So you really get a feel for every facet of the creation of a film. And I think that, for me at least, you know, it fits my profile, because I really like to tinker, to discover things, learn new things. So I might learn a bit more from sound design, sound editing a film. For this piece, that was like diving into Unity during the process and trying to figure out how everything works. How do you build like a project like this? So that's more my background. And then I think that's very complementary with Kate's background in the creative writing, the directing of actors, and the creative collaboration. And we worked together in that aspect for quite a few years already. She is a director and then me as a cinematographer. So together we already had established this relationship of how do we dissect a story into a script and then into a visual script. How do we shoot it, edit, and so on and so on. So that relationship was already there professionally, you could say, when we dive into this project.
Yeah, and so I had a chance to watch your artist statement, and it sounds like this is kind of born out of a very personal story. So maybe you could give a bit more context for how The Long Goodbye first came about.
So when I was a teenager, I would visit my grandfather every day after school. He lived like basically one street away from my school. And my grandfather, his wife passed away. And then from then on, he was all alone at home. And that kind of started this process accelerated a process for his Alzheimer's. And I would visit him every day after school, and I would see how he progressed and his condition progressed over a few years, until at some point we really had to put him into a nursing home. But he lived at home for quite a long time still. We tried to, because it was really like his passion. Like, he had this house with a beautiful garden, and he would work in the garden all day, and that was like his paradise. And he had so much pleasure of waking up every day and being in the garden and working in the garden that we didn't want to take that away from him. So my mother, she put a lot of effort into caring for him as a caretaker and trying to make sure that he could stay at home for as long as possible. And that planted the seed of you know, or the question maybe, how does he perceive the world and how does he experience that journey that he's on? And it's a complicated relationship because he was, you know, the type of person who would establish a lot of like what we would call like camouflage kind of reactions. So his behavior was constantly trying to hide the fact that he didn't understand some things anymore, or he didn't remember certain people. And I was quite, you know, of course, it's an extremely emotional journey for everyone, but it's also a time in, you know, where you're trying to really understand that other person, to make sure you're not distressing them, to make sure their quality of life is really as good as it can be. And for me, it was interesting and fascinating too. And when he forgot who I was, like at some point I arrived at his place and I could tell by his eyes that he didn't remember who I was. And his first reaction was trying to hide the fact that he had forgotten. So he knew that it was very painful, you know, or scary, and that he wanted to hide or the shame of, oh, I don't know who this person is anymore. I forgot his name. Something I have, you know, every day as well. And then what he would do is trying to find these coping mechanisms to either through jokes or through, you know, stories that my identity would also change so it would fit his worldview. So instead of his grandson, I was suddenly like his school director from his elementary school. And then for some reason, I got that identity from that day. And then that identity stuck with me. And it was never really clear whether that started as a joke. I think it did, but then it stuck with him as well. So then we both kind of understood that, okay, now I'm the school director. So every day I entered his home, he would speak to me also with a lot of respect because it was like, oh, it's a school director. You have to, you know, be very careful what you say to him. And of course, you know, it's that personal connection that I had. And of course, for me, it was easier, I guess, in a way, because I was his grandson. But then seeing how my mother dealt with, you know, the struggle of caring for someone who sometimes doesn't want to be helped, who, you know, will call in the middle of the night in panic, who will call the police because he has these hallucinations. And being able to follow that up close, it left an impression on me. And it took a few years to finally find a way to tackle the subject. And originally there was a different script attached to it for a linear film. But then at some point, you know, I got to know VR and I felt that this medium and the way it can make you feel, there was something there, like, even though that was very early on and the projects weren't very established yet. It was like Google Cardboard kind of still that time frame. But then if you now look a few years later, it's been such a progression in the storytelling that it can achieve now. And then together we said, this is the way it has to be told. And it took quite a long time because it, you know, for us as cinema, you know, linear film creators, there's a lot of challenges that we needed to overcome. But, you know, especially in the scripts phase, it took a while to really nail down all the details and to understand also some technical stuff. But I think it's, you know, I think it's really the story and the way it's told now is really close to the vision we wanted to present, I think. And the different elements we try to touch in the personal relationship between the two main characters, Ina and Daniel, is also the subjects we wanted to talk about, which isn't always, you know, we didn't want to just make something extremely negative. We also wanted to have some, you know, a touch of humor here and there and some moments of lightness, but that it really touches those both sides and that you can feel a progression throughout the story as well in this relationship and how it changes between the two characters over time. And not only between those people, but also between the main character and her environment and how that changes over time. And, you know, from their point of view, from their subjective world experience.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear from your perspective as you're coming in onto this project and collaborating and where you started to begin to try to either pull out information about the story or try to figure out the characters that it was going to be, you know, because it sounds like for you, your experience, it was a grandson-grandfather relationship. And there's a piece here a couple of years ago at Venice called Emperor, which was around the daughter and the father. So you have, you know, in this piece, deciding to do like more of a partnership of that relationship that creates a new dynamic of getting another story. So just curious to hear where you began in starting to piece together and research and pull all the different parts together to tell the story.
Well, I think it's also like telling a very personal story, like an autobiographical one, comes with many challenges. And we have a background in fiction storytelling that's also so different from documentary, right? And we love documentary as viewers, as an audience, but I think it also never occurred to us to turn it into like a documentary project. I think we always wanted to tell a fictional story because we were also inspired by other elements, like my grandmother, for instance, who is fortunately still alive. She's still with us, and she inspires us in different ways. So we really wanted it to be a piece about an elderly woman also, who has a strong personality, who is very passionate. So we also wanted to have a female protagonist. And I think we did a lot of research. So we, of course, we started from Victor's personal story, but we found it so important to stay truthful and respectful to the reality of Alzheimer's. So we talked to a lot of experts, professors, the expertise center of dementia in Flanders, the region where we're from. We also interviewed a woman who is living with dementia in the very early stages, caretakers. And from all those elements, we distilled a fictional story, so to speak. And because one of the reasons also we chose to create a fictional character is also because we wanted to specifically talk about the loving relationship and the impact Alzheimer's has on the relationship between the woman living with dementia, the person living with dementia, and his or her caretaker. So that was a very specific angle we wanted to focus on while writing and creating the story. Because, I don't know, I think it was a very intuitive thing that we were drawn to this perspective, but also while talking to various people in our research stage, we felt that there was a deep need, because caretakers are sometimes a little bit forgotten, right? Like, it's the specific perspective we really wanted to address, because it's so important, because the caretaker really becomes the universe of the person living with dementia. And I think something important, like, from this perspective, what was really important was for us, I mean, there's a lot of different stories you can tell about dementia, and each life is so individual. But I think what we really believe strongly is that people are never their condition. So people living with dementia are never just their dementia. Dementia is a part of them. But these individuals, they have had very rich lives, and their lives are still very rich, and their inner lives are also still very rich. And the challenge becomes that this condition makes it more difficult to sometimes communicate. I mean, it makes it more difficult to communicate with the people around you, with the world. It is extremely challenging. We don't want to minimize this, but what we would love to focus on is telling this story that is so... We don't shy away from the difficult aspects of Alzheimer's, not at all. There's scenes where there's panic and fear, but there's also just so much love and tenderness and... Yeah, we really hope that people can find some comfort in this story, and you know, seeing the first reactions, people are really moved by it, because unfortunately most people know someone or are affected by it in their personal lives. And yeah, we really hope to sort of send this message to hold on to the shared affection, and there is still so much, you know, like that can be cherished, even though it is very challenging, of course.
Just a clarifying question, because in the piece, there's the woman who has dementia, Alzheimer's, and then the male protagonist. Was that male protagonist, was that her husband, or was that her caretaker that we're listening to?
Both. So he is the caretaker. Well, they're still living together at home. And yeah, so he's her husband, Daniel, and he's her caretaker. But Daniel, I don't know, should I say this? I don't know. I never know if I should give too much away from the story, but like, I think what he struggles with emotionally is that he realizes he will no longer be there for very long, and he really has this struggle of, you know, having to let her go soon and leaving her behind. And that's also where the voiceover comes from. Like, the voiceover we've created, it comes from this deep desire of Daniel to... It's an emotional desire. Unfortunately, people with dementia, who live with dementia, they will reach a point where they can no longer comprehend voice notes. because the concept is that you are guided through the experience through tape recorders, and those are conversations between Daniel and his wife, Ida, the protagonist. And he sort of tries to prompt memories to keep them alive in some way. But also, he leaves behind little notes to help her take care of herself. And, you know, realistically, it's just this deep desire to stay behind with her in some way, to be able to take care of her in some way. And, yeah, that's where their relationship came from.
Yeah, in the moment, I was seeing him as primarily the husband, but I guess he's also technically the caretaker in this case. So, but when you said caretaker, I thought, you know, in America, sometimes they have other external caretakers that come in that...
Yeah. But, I mean, this is not... Yeah, of course, they are surrounded by a medical team, but we focused on the relationship between them. But, yeah, of course, they're not isolated in the world, obviously. They also have a daughter, a grandson.
Well, this piece is very moving, and I felt like... The music and the score was a big part of that, but also the story that's being told. And there are moments where you have like interactions that we can dig into, the ways that you're creating this kind of more embodied or interactive experience. But it's, you know, for the most part, a linear story that's being told and gated by these little small interactive moments. But maybe you could speak a little bit to the music, because that seemed to be such a core part of the emotional tenor of the piece, to really drop into the emotions.
Yeah, for the music, we really wanted to work with this, we think, amazing Dutch composer and pianist, Joep Beving, because he makes such beautiful, nostalgic, vulnerable compositions. And they are so simple, is not the right word, can come across the wrong way, but they are so pure and they really speak to your heart. 2 hours at least, and we just knew, like, oh, he has to do it, because our character Ida, she was a pianist and a composer, but we really wanted the musical composition to be like intimate, as if she's playing it for her husband Daniel, right? Like, so she gave concerts, but we really told you, like, the music has to be intimate. It can't be like a grand concert composition, and or like as if it sounds as if it's performed by an orchestra. It has to be vulnerable and intimate, and he composed several themes, one for Daniel, one for Ida, and then one for them together. And what was also very important to us is that we at some point could feel in the composition that she loses her ability to play, and we think he has done that so brilliantly, because we had no idea, like, there was a concept we had, but I think he really managed to, in a very emotional way, create this moment where the music starts to slow down and stop and become so vulnerable, to get into this experience, what it must have been like for her to lose the ability. And yeah, so we're really happy. Maybe you want to add something?
I think, like, we did a lot of testing with him as well. Like, it took quite a long time to get to the end score, but I think throughout that process we had like 3-4 maybe more pianos that we tried out. So for some scenes, it's more like this, you know, really concerts piano, like a very, very beautiful piano. And then for other ones, it's a very small, old, crooked, you know, with false notes kind of sounding piano that has a lot of texture into it. And finding the right, I don't know if it's in English the same words, timbre, like for the tone, maybe, yeah, for the music was important for us. And it was really a nice journey with him to kind of find the right tone for certain places and texture and, you know, the pacing. And we gave him a lot of feedback and input, but then how he used that input and then made the final score really helped immensely, you know, his experience, his creativity. And then especially once we had like images to show him, starting from like concept art to like the real experience, it went to an even another level. And so it was nice that we started very early to have that sound dev phase, you could say, if you're the music dev, and then how that progressed throughout. I think if you listen to the early ideas, I think he made like 10 compositions had been the beginning, and then we just said, okay, we'll pick this one, and then we developed that one further, and then he had another 5, and then we developed another one further. So this iterative process of making a VR piece was also present in this music, and that was really a joy for us, because it really allowed us to fine-tune at what moment, like a certain note plays, help trigger certain emotions, to trigger that emotional response in an audience, that was important for us because we were afraid otherwise we'd have a beautiful composition, but that it wouldn't quite fit in the right place. And even at the last minute, he was, you know, able to shorten and lengthen certain compositions per our request for the final, like, experience edit, you could say, the final build. It was a joy to work with him. Absolute pleasure, yeah.
Yeah, I found it really a moving score and helped to build on the emotions of the story that was being told. And I did notice that near the end, it starts to kind of decompose, or it sounds like wrong notes or dissonant notes are being played to kind of replicate the losing of the memory. And because with XR, generally you have this different design disciplines with like game design, interactivity, you have the cinematic tradition, which it sounds like that this was mostly a pretty well scripted out story. But you also have the world building and the aesthetic and the design, which I think is another key part of this, just this really beautiful painterly interpretations of places, of these different scenes, and it's composited in this white void space that things will come and go, this playing with change blindness idea where you turn and you see things appear and disappear. So again, playing with this concept of the way that our memories are very ephemeral, or be there one moment and gone the next. So I really felt that. And the world design, the full spatial, moving beyond just the 2D frame, but into this full 3D space. And so, yeah, just curious to hear a little bit more around this process of developing the aesthetic and translating this into a fully 360 degree story.
No, I'm very glad to hear your words. I mean, that's very well put, especially like because you mentioned change blindness. That was something that in the original script used a lot more of, but then throughout this process, we had to kind of fine tune or, you know, change the script here and there. I think in terms of scripts, like it was all written out. And then, of course, in discussion with the crew, we just developed on it. But for us, one of the key ideas that was important was, like, in film, you have this idea of editing in time. And time is a very important cornerstone of a film. But in this immersive media, you get this extra dimension of position and place, and of course scale. But we wanted to have this idea of, how should I say, persistence. So you can be in one place and then another place appears and then you go to the next place, but you can feel it's in the same place. You're not standing still. You're really wandering throughout a story. And then when you get to a new place, you look behind yourself and then the previous place fades away and it disappears. And I think that idea for us was really important because it adds to, I think, both the emotional aspect of things appearing and being lost, or this feeling of remembrance in certain places and certain times. And then I think another element that was very important for us was the kind of the medical term for this confabulation. It's like a misconstrued or, you know, misremembered memory, and how memory changes, especially in the later stages or after, you know, a car accident and brain damage. Memories tend to change and the brain tries to find a way to hold together this semblance of identity. So we wanted to introduce this idea where in the first scene you're discovering a rather, you know, normal setting. And then at some point at the end of that scene, you could say, we open up this world and we move more from an objective world to more of a subjective world. And elements of that objective world start to come back. They're out of place. They don't belong there. And that kind of helps give this feeling of, I remember, you know, there's things that are familiar, but there are always things that are unfamiliar as well. So, and that idea of this place that is brittle, things that sometimes come back, also like because we were talking about music earlier, this idea of things that come back in the music and the composition, they change, they store throughout the experience, and then, you know, they come back at the end. We wanted to do that with the world as well. And together, I think, with our art director as well, and Daniel Balazs, and our CG supervisor, Gael Chez, I think we had like a star team. They kind of came on us path by accident, really. And we were so grateful and so happy to have them on board, because they really put this world to the next level. And we, together with them, you know, we tried to discover a workflow or an idea of how can we represent this world. And it had to be this, you know, from the start we had this idea of a painterly analog feel, because that brings the brittleness, the texture, you know, something that can be fading over time. And then we started doing the same thing, like analyzing paintings, you could say, analyzing our inspirations, fine-tuning a look in 2D, and then switching to 3D, and then bringing that idea to the world building. So, for instance, in the painting, you always have this point of focus where this is the main story, and then you start to diffuse outwards. And we wanted to do the same idea in 3D as well, where there's a point of focus. This is the core of the painting, the story, and then the rest outwards is diffused. And then we dive deeper, and we even did it in like the 3D models, the meshes. Like, okay, how can we make a table or a chair that is a representation of a chair, but you feel that it has an organic analog look to it? And that required a lot of testing and you know, for instance, okay, how many polygons do you need, or how many bevels can we put on a chair before it looks kind of silly? Or, you know, when you don't have enough, it looks very much like a 3D object. And I think without that amount of detail, that precision, even though it might not be visible always, I think you can feel it. Because if you just have a mesh that is too simple and then you put some texturing on it, it doesn't work. It has to really be a collaboration of placement, of layout, the meshes, and then the texturing on top. So the combination of these two people, of Daniela and Gael, was essential. And together we really looked for ways, you know, with the time that was allowed, of course, to approach this analog feel. And I think in a few, you know, it's very interesting if you look to the original concept art of the scenes and then you look to the 3D environment, it's almost a match. And the difference, I think, what we wanted to do for our piece is that it's real 3D environment. You can move objects, like they are really textured. There's interactivity in the world, which sometimes makes it a bit more difficult to achieve that style. But we definitely, I think, at least I'm very happy, and I think you are as well, what we achieved. And for instance, one of the details that we'd like to focus on was this, you have the same idea in animation as well. If you look at like a Miyazaki animation, and it's this idea of contact points where objects meet each other. That is so important. So where a table meets the floor, you need to think ahead in terms of like mesh, but also in texturing, how do those two things meet? In a painting, it's one kind of, you know, brush stroke. So you need to find a way to put the texturing of the floor on the chair and vice versa as well, so they mix and blend. And then it starts to come together as a piece. Otherwise, you really feel like this is a room filled with separated objects and 3D environments. And that's something we wanted to avoid at all costs. Especially, I think something Danielle also did beautifully is the feeling of the texture of the painting style in, for instance, floors in the sky. You can really feel like how the paint is drying on the floor and how information is diffused. And it did such a wonderful job of trying to visualize this idea of a decaying memory into a visual landscape.
Yeah, what's interesting about this piece in memory is that my memory of it is that I was walking into a painting, and that as you're describing the 3D objects, I was like, oh, I guess it actually was like 3D meshes, but it very much felt like it was something that was painted on a canvas. And so in terms of getting that painterly look, was that just all in like Substance Painter and texturing, or were you using references from like paintings, or was there like generative AI? All these questions, I was trying to get a sense of how to achieve that type of like look and feel.
So it was a very long process. So at first we had a look dev that consisted of, which was with a different team, of making 3D objects, and then they would paint the texture in Substance Painter, I think it was. But there were two things for us that were very clear from the start. Someone has to do this manually. You cannot really use like this tiled approach. Every object has to be done by hand. And the same for meshes. Like you could say, if Gael made like a chair and then you pick one from the Unity Asset Store, for instance, and you put them together, it's such a big difference. Even there, the attention to detail is important. And we had a long process of also using generative AI to fine-tune the look, which was before our art director came on board, because we had a lot of information, a lot of ideas of color and texture in terms of painting style. And then we basically used generative AI to kind of create a model that would allow us to create references for basically everything in the piece. So we had this enormous catalog of, I don't know, 300 pages of different chairs, tables, butterflies, and everything.
So more of the concept art phase that then would be handed over to the art director that then actually implement it.
Exactly, yeah.
He did like then enhance it with his own concept art. So, but this was more for us to, because we're not visual artists, so we had to find a way to communicate to the team. But then Danielle absolutely went from there, and because it gave him a sense what our vision was, and it was already very coherent, because usually you work with very, you know, a myriad of references from different paintings or whatever, and now it was a coherent visual style, which he really enhanced and brought to another level.
And I think that what makes especially Danielle so unique is that he's a painter, but he has so much experience with 3D and VR. So he's also thinking about the visual storytelling in an immersive setting. And because of that, he brings something to the table that we didn't have, and that was very complementary, I think, with our input. And yeah, like you said, he brought it to the next level of how we should also technically approach it and what to avoid.
Yeah, the other experience that I had about this piece was that you don't have a very large space here at Venice Immersive, but I felt like you used all the space you had available to the fullest extent, because when you're in VR, you have this capability of expanding out, but you have this teleport mechanic where you have these butterflies that are popping up. And, you know, it did feel seamless in the sense of staying persistent in one world, and then I was teleporting, and that, you know, because I was thinking, oh, were there edits in this piece? Because it felt like it was like seamlessly kind of going from one world to the next, but there were ways of pulling up these places in the distance, and then you get closer, and then that is sort of like a jump cut of sorts, because you're just getting closer from distance and from afar. But still, there was a sense of persistence of the world, but it felt really quite seamless as I was going on this journey. And then I just remember a couple of times of like, how am I not bumping into the wall right now? Like, so when you were doing this teleport mechanic across these different spaces, is there any tricks you had to do in terms of when you were teleporting, if someone's at this point in the room, then they need to be in this point in the room because they need to be able to walk to this place without running into the wall? Or like, was there any advanced logic like that? Or just curious to hear a little bit more around the process of designing the overall spatial journey that you wanted to take people on.
Very good question. I think that it took a lot of testing, and it was something that we had a lot of experiments. Our developer, Frederick from Polygoat, did such an amazing job. I mean, we had so many meetings about this. But basically what it came down to is trying to, in the script phase already, before there was even a layout, trying to imagine that you're, what is like the ideal place to arrive and what is the ideal place to depart, and then build the world around that idea, just to kind of minimize the amount of player drift that happens from the center point. And in some places, from that starting point, we then decided, okay, but when you arrive, we want you to have this perspective. So, for instance, we had a discussion with Danielle and Gael as well at the start, where at first the scene was laid out in a normal way, where you could say the walls are oriented in the shape of a box. And when you go from teleport from the first place to the second place, you're looking at it from a logical angle. But then we said, okay, we don't want that. We want to have like this angle that you're looking at a piece from afar, like a painting, and then you're going into this painting. That's the idea. And then we had to test it, because you sometimes may feel that this place is starting to fall apart. You know, in the geometry, it doesn't make sense anymore, because when you depart from the first place and, you know, four hops in, you're basically back at the start. So you're basically doing the circle all the time, but that helps us a lot in laying out the scenes so that a player, you know, avoids running into walls as much as possible. It still happens. you know, we did a lot of player testing, and there was people, you know, who wanted to run off into the distance around tables, around, you know, you have those kind of people. But like technically, you're really teleporting to the next place, because you could also say that the place teleports to your position, but then you often have the problem that you are behind a wall, for instance, or inside of a table. And that's something you have to avoid at all costs, because that breaks the immersion even more, I think. Like being able to end up outside of a map or a level instead of you running into a guardian at some point. You know, that's also really immersive, you know, immersion breaking, but it's the lesser of two evils. And then it was really about fine-tuning those positions where you arrive and depart, to drawings on the floor, how far do people go, and then making a map. And because you're always turning around in the circle, the drift from the center is usually okay. In some places, people run into issues, but usually, you know, we manage. And I think that was like one of the big challenges that we didn't, I think, foresee coming from our background. And we probably could have improved even with further testing and further development, but I'm happy in the state that it is right now.
Yeah. I thought it was really quite seamless, and one of those things where there's a lot of stuff happening on the back end, or the way that you're designing my body moving through space to kind of architect the movement through the spatial journey of the piece, that was a lot more sophisticated than maybe immediately obvious. But I think one of the other key parts of this piece are just these kind of moments of light interactivity. And, you know, you are embodied in this piece where you're able to pick up a mirror. And, you know, I guess there's a bit of a symbolic journey of the mirror over time, where you can sort of see yourself at the beginning, and then later on you can't see yourself, the mirror's broken. But probably the core mechanic is that the whole conceit of the piece is that you have the husband who's interviewing his wife and capturing these memories, and then you have this ability to start to push the play button of and listen to the tape recorder. So it's a little bit of a gating of the next narrative bit. There's not necessarily any agency that's changing the direction of the narrative, but it's just also, like, when you think about film, it's like a very much a time-based medium, and you want to, as editor, control the unfolding of that. But here in the spatial experience of a VR piece, you have the ability to surrender that agency over to the user to then push play. And then what do you do if they don't push play? Do you automatically play? You know, there might has to be fallbacks a lot of times in the festival context, but just curious to hear a little bit more around that process of trying to create moments of interactivity in this piece.
So yeah, we, as you already mentioned, Friedrich Smolders from Polygoat, our developer, he has done such an amazing job. And yeah, I think the interactivity was important for us because, as you said, why did we choose virtual reality? Is because when you put on a headset, you ask yourself, who am I and where am I? And this really connects so strongly to the experience of living with dementia. But we also wanted the journey to be a journey of discovery. And so I think, I mean, it really is a journey in which you have to sort of search who you are and what your story is. Also through environmental storytelling. So you, through little post-its, postcards, photos, all the little elements and little personal belongings of Ida, you can pick them up, you can interact with them, you, little by little, as if it's pieces of a puzzle, you discover who you are and what your journey is. That was very important to us, to have this sense that people can get lost in the universe in a way, and at the same time be surprised, because they can discover so much. I mean, some scenes more than others, but, and also how these elements, like for instance the post-its, they become more nonsensical over time, and information is transferred, changes over the course of the experience, and that was important to us.
Yeah, just curious to hear around the settling upon the tape recorder conceit as a way of telling the story.
I think the tape recorder, it was important for us. The tape recorder was also this ritual they could do together. The moment he would realize that he was also going through a process of his own and he might not be there forever, he wanted to create this ritual where they could be together and talk about their lives and bring up memories. And I think the tape recorder just felt the most natural way, because it has also this intimate tactile sound, and if you hear the tape recorder sound, you can really imagine this intimate moment between these two people. It also, of course, becomes a point of orientation where people can flow through the experience and go from scene to scene in a way that they feel as if they are embraced by these two people. Because one of the audience members who saw it said, like, I feel I really know her. And that was such a beautiful response. And I think, of course, many elements add to this, but I think the tape recorder really is this element that, and also because it's a little thing, the fact that you can interact with it and you see that the light pops on and the sound of it, all these little details. I mean, the emotion really is in the details. But this really brings these characters to life as real human beings, I think. So that's why we chose for these narrative devices.
Yeah, and with the post-it notes, you also expanded that out into the installation part, which I think that was also a nice way of creating a bit of a magic circle before entering in. And there's a couple other things that were kind of striking visually as I was watching this piece. One was just how you went up to the images sometimes and they would start to animate in this animated GIF type of way. But also there was a scene where you have a refrigerator that opens up and then you kind of see it as a portal in another realm. It reminded me very much of like a Meow Wolf type of conceit where they have refrigerator open up and you walk into a portal into another realm. But just curious, any comments on some of these more dreamlike configurations of realities that you're starting to blur together?
Yeah. Well, I think the theme of Alzheimer's is you can go so many different ways in terms of tone, right? If you want to tell a story about dementia. But because we really wanted to focus also on the love and the tenderness of this couple, we had to find ways to find it's a very thin line we were walking, and we had to find this fine balance between being very truthful to the reality with all the difficulties and the painful side of it as well. But at the same time, I think to open up people's hearts to the story, you got to, how shall I say it? You have to soften the experience in a way. And I think for us, introducing magical realist elements was a way to make the whole experience gentle. I think we really thought also in terms of writing the screenplay, we really created the scenes in such a way that we chose to balance and choreograph the order of themes according to certain themes that are aligned with Alzheimer's. So we have themes that are about fear and others that are about confusion. There's a scene about nostalgia. There's a scene about the intimacy of their relationship. But we hope it's not noticeable. But we did balance it in such a way that you do sometimes dive into the darkness and then the lightness takes you out again into another scene. So it becomes this flow that very much resembles the real life experience that people have who are living with dementia, because you have these beautiful, loving moments where there's a really strong, powerful connection between, you know, family members. But then there can be a moment of panic and sadness and fear. And that is really the daily life people are living with, and that's really something. I mean, it took us a long time to coordinate the scenes in such a way that they would flow together to come really close to this real life experience.
And maybe to come back as well to the idea of the visual language, I think like for people who are going on this journey, like we're talking about earlier, their relationship to other people changes, but also to the world, and objects change and their function changes. So a trash bin might, for instance, become like a collection box for very important items, or a cupboard might become a door. So I think it fits quite well with the theme, like you could say, you know, medically, but their world experience also kind of goes in that direction, and that tied into the confabulation again that we were talking about earlier. So it brings this, and of course, you know, it sometimes also just happens that, you know, when you're going on this journey that you have these hallucinations that maybe, for instance, you look out the window and you see people sitting in the trees, you know, and instead of birds, there's people sitting in a tree. So I think it aligns very well with the theme, you know, from an experience background, from their point of view, their subjective worldview. And then, like you were saying, it ties very beautifully, I think, into the balancing of what are we trying to talk about, and balancing the beautiful moments, and also reinforcing that it doesn't just have to be a dark journey. It can also be a magical journey at times, and trying to balance those two between each other. Because that was a challenge, especially as well during funding, is that you have people who are going on this journey during different phases. So people who are very new to having someone who is living with dementia, they might have the reaction of, oh, it has to be much more negative. But someone who has gone through a lot of these situations, for instance, professors are sometimes like, let's also focus on like the beautiful moments or the magical moments of what these people are still experiencing and how they are still enjoying life as well. And that was important for us.
And also the passions, because we all have rich lives and we have certain passions that are very important to us. And one of the professors we talked to, Professor Van den Bulke, who is affiliated with the KU Leuven, which is a university in Belgium, university hospital, he also wrote several books, and his vision is that people, you know, you might be someone who has been a historian professionally, and he may not be able to engage in conversations about history anymore when he's further away into his journey of Alzheimer's, but he will still enjoy being present. And these passions, they stay with us. And I think this, to come back to one of your earlier questions, we really wanted to create a character that has a strong passion for us and for Ida. It's obviously music, and we thought it would be so beautiful to put a passion at the center of the experience. And I think also the musical composition became like the beating heart of the experience that really accompanies the audience through the journey. And that was also very important for us, to really put passion that people have had at the center of the story.
Yeah, and I have to ask around Emperor VR piece, because it's a VR piece that's also got a very painterly style, also similarly around dementia. And, you know, in that case, it's got a different parent relationship, but very strong writing in that piece as well, I think, in this piece. And so, yeah, just curious to hear any thoughts around coming across Emperor while in the midst of working on The Long Goodbye, since there's obviously a lot of parallels and overlaps and, you know, just some things that you took in terms of like, oh, there's, for me, I think they're still very distinct in different pieces. And I actually found the Long Goodbye was moving me emotionally a lot more than Emperor, even though I thought Emperor was very well done and really enjoyed it. It kind of leaned more into magical realism, surrealism, and also learned in that piece and talking to the creators of how they were using combinations of language into new words and how that got translated into spatial objects that then created this whole kind of dreamlike magical realism components to it. But yeah, just curious to hear any thoughts on Emperor and how that may have influenced or not influenced the Long Goodbye.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. Well, actually, we pitched this project in the financing market here in 2023 when Emperor was selected. So we discovered the piece and was like, oh, there are a lot of similarities. And also the creators at Astrea had also had the same reaction. So then we met and we talked about it. Yeah, there are many similarities, but I think, and we admire and adored the experience. We think it's brilliantly done. I think we try to really focus on, how shall I say this? We try to focus on a different approach, and I think that is the intimacy between these two lovers, right? And from this, everything else was created. So in terms of the vision we had on the player's journey, interactivity, everything is based on the decisions we've made on the story first and what needed to be told emotionally. So I think in terms of differences, what is important to point out is also that we did, in the beginning, I think there was a little bit more similarities in terms of visual style, which we then moved away from because we realized, like, of course, yeah, it's important to stay close to our own vision. And then one of the most important decisions was that we created a very colorful world, which ended up matching very well our vision of bringing memories to life and also playing with how color and darkness and lightness fits the meaning of scenes. Maybe you want to add something else?
Yeah, like you said, it was quite a surprise because when we were here, then Emperor kind of suddenly popped in and we had concept art. And we had no idea Emperor was like being built or like releasing at that point in time. And it was so similar. We had concept art that is so similar, for instance, to the poster they have. And like the visual language, if you come from the same direction, you have like the same ideas sometimes, the same input. And I think there were a few things that we changed. Like you said, at first we had the idea of black and white also playing a big role in our piece. But then we kind of moved away from that, and we really wanted to make something that was colorful, which was always going to be the case, but we also had a black and white element to it. And for instance, I remember that they also had like an inspiration from like Chinese ink. That was also something we were playing with as an inspiration. So I guess that was a good, also a blessing in a way, because that allowed us to also kind of reimagine some things to differentiate ourselves. Because I think in the end, it's a beautiful piece, and that allows them to be complementary. And we were also at Itva Doc Lab, for instance. There was another piece as well, but also once you talk about dementia, that was like in development, I think, or they were pitching. And I think at some point it's interesting to imagine this screening, this exhibit, where you have these different experiences playing at the same time, where people, it's like built around a team, like a bundle of stories being told. That would be interesting, I think, from my point of view. However, I also think we made a lot of different changes in direction, like what we were talking about earlier about the persistence of things, that it's not something that pops in and pops out, but that you have a bit more of an immersive feeling of wandering throughout this story and getting lost along the way, where it becomes, you know, it starts as the realist world and then slowly you meandering, just like following this meandering river, you drift off into this more subjective experience. And then, of course, I think, put a bit more emphasis on what you were talking about, that personal journey of those two, because that was a very challenging question during the screenwriting phase of how are we going to tackle the story when one of the protagonists cannot really start a conversation anymore or ask questions. Some things are becoming quite difficult at that point in, you know, that stage. And then the idea of having those conversations being recorded between the two suddenly gave us such a new dimension to really talk about their relationship at the same time while they are talking about something else. Even though they are not understanding each other throughout a recording that they created, you know, it's while sitting in the kitchen, for instance, Daniel wants to talk about something important, you know, the fact that he's ill. But Ida can't follow that conversation anymore. And the conversation drifts into a different direction. So there's this layered emotion in the dialogues as well. At least I think that was the attempt of, this is the intent of the dialogue, but it's sidetracked sometimes because this condition is, you know, interfering with their communication. But at the core, like the love between the two, that communication still perseveres, it still exists, and that's what still drives them throughout their relation, throughout their lives.
Yeah, thanks for that. So finally, I'd love to hear what you think the ultimate potential of XR and immersive storytelling might be, and what it might be able to enable.
Let me think. I'm not a quick answerer. I need to let it sink in. Well, I think for me, especially, the reason why we dove into XR is because classic cinema absolutely has its limits. And I think, especially seeing the responses we're now getting, people feel so close to these characters and they feel so close to the, it also brings them very close to their own personal experiences that they may or may not go through in their own lives. And I really, truly think this is because of the interactivity. This is because you can really immerse yourself in a character. We really, I'm not sure, I guess it's clear for the listeners by now, but you really arrive into the experience being Ida. So this is just something that classic cinema cannot do. And I think for me, what interests me personally as a creator working with virtual reality is that it allows me to bring people even more close to their emotions and connect them to themes that I'm very eager to talk about, that I think are important to talk about. But also what is very important to us is, like, we hope to have a artistic trajectory where we can show the project at festivals and then hopefully online. But what's very important to us is also that we will bring the VR experiences to training programs, to nursery homes, to really have an impact where people need it the most. Caretakers, people who are living, well, maybe it's too confrontational for people who are living with dementia or have been diagnosed, but the people around them. And that's really from the conversations we have with the field, there is such a deep need for not medical stories, but personal ones that bring comfort and maybe also perspective in a way. And so, yeah, that's, I think, the potential that I see, at least for this project, but virtual reality and XR in general, it can really bring people closer and, yeah, immerse people in themes in a way that classic cinema cannot.
Yeah, I think that from my perspective, if I look at, you know, being, you know, very grateful that we were here in 2023 with Production Bridge and being able to see a lot of experiences as well, it's astonishing how rapidly we are, I think, also progressing. I remember, like, in 2023, people were saying, oh, it's over, it's everything's dead, and, you know, like, you had a lot of pessimism as well, I think. But I think it's, I don't think that's the correct assumption to make at all. I think that we are really now discovering how powerful this medium can be. And we have so many ideas that, especially, like, during the script phase, and, of course, helped by our two coaches, Yvonne Van Olden and David Calvet, of what we can potentially do. And there's so much more we would love to discover and experiment with. And it's true, there's a lot of challenges as well in, you know, different facets of the production and also in how we construct these pieces. But I think if we are already seeing these sorts of reactions that are really driving people to tears and, you know, where people are saying, oh, this helped me, I think that's, you know, of course, that's also possible with film, but in this environment, it really seems to touch people on another level, something that I haven't really seen before with cinema, linear film. And I think with a few more years and more experimentation, I think more and more people will come around to the idea of XR as well. And I'm starting to notice it as well, where between 2023, for instance, a lot of my friends have started asking about, oh, should I buy a headset? You know, I'm kind of interested in it. And, like, I do think there's a lot of interested people here outside of even, the XR bubble that we are maybe in that sometimes don't quite understand yet how far developed these pieces are becoming. For instance, like, we had a journalist who was so pleasantly surprised by seeing the experience that it was like, we have to talk about this. We have to talk about this in the news. This is quite astonishing. You know, it's not about our experience per se, but, like, just the idea. And sometimes just people need to, you know, we need to reach them and find ways of saying, like, hey, come and have a look. Like, this is maybe something you've never experienced before. And I remember back in the day, it was Google Cardboard, and it was like, okay, that's cool, that's interesting. And it was very hard to imagine what are the next steps. But I think now we're reaching a point where outsiders are going to be able to start seeing, like, okay, now I get it. Now I'm starting to find a connection with this medium. And I think that will be a big next step.
Awesome. Well, Long Goodbye certainly brought me to tears. I thought it was very emotionally moving and very well-told story. And just the way that you're using the medium to take us on this spatial journey, but give us this kind of embodied experience. And, yeah, just a very intimate, well-told story. And, yeah, just really appreciated having a chance to see it and have a chance to sit down with both of you today to help break it all down. So thanks again for joining me here on the podcast.
Thank you. I mean, yeah, what can I say? We're so overwhelmed by the responses of people. We were totally unprepared. And it makes me so emotional to see people emotional. But at the same time, that's what you want, right? You want to create something that can be meaningful. And yeah, it means so much to me what you're saying. And I'm a bit emotional right now. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to talk so extensively. And yeah, taking the time. Thanks.
Yeah, it's been a wonderful experience being here with our piece, and especially because we have this installation with the post-its now, and then people are writing their, like, review on a post-it and putting it on the walls. It, like, it becomes this, like, extra dimension, this extra immersive piece. Like, it's growing over time, so hopefully over time it can grow a lot more in different exhibits, and then at some point it's like a room filled with experiences, with responses. So it's, I'm very, very grateful also to Venice to allowing us to showcase it here.
Awesome, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for tuning into this Venice Immersive 2025 coverage, and hopefully you found some use in some of this documentation of these experiences that are very ephemeral. And some of these show at these festivals and they don't really go out widely beyond this a lot of times. I mean, maybe they are, but you may not be in a place that it's easy for you to see them. And so it's a real privilege to be able to see all these experiences, but also to be able to sit down with these creators and have a really deep, in-depth conversation in a way that there are not a lot of other opportunities to really dig into at this level. And so I really appreciate all the time from all the creators to be able to have these conversations, but also for you to take the time to listen to them. And also, it's been a challenge of trying to find a way of speaking about these experiences in an abstract, theoretical way, or at least in a way that I can ground it and allow you to put yourself into the experiences to kind of imagine some of these different things that they're doing, how I'm experiencing it, but also the different types of design decisions that the creator is making. So if you find this useful and want to support this type of effort of both documenting the history of immersive storytelling, but also to support this kind of wildly ambitious independent journalism project that is very much driven by support by listeners like yourself. So please do consider becoming a member of the Patreon at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.